This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. Ralph Nader is one of these people, and he made a difference. Ralph Nader is America's most renowned and effective crusader for the rights of consumers and the general public, a role that has repeatedly brought him into conflict with both business and government. As an advocate, Ralph created an organization of young lawyers and researchers, often called Nader's Raiders, who produce the systematic exposés of industrial hazards, pollution, unsafe products, and governmental neglect of consumer safety laws. Nader is widely recognized as the founder of the consumer's right movement. He played a key role in the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the Freedom of Information Act, and Free Media Like Ours. He also has contributed to the work of consumer safety for the reform political system through his group Public Citizen. So if you have a child that drives in a car or are suffering from health issues related to environmental pollution, or you need regulations that protect you on the job, you have Ralph Nader to either ask for his help or thank for his help. Hello, Mr. Nader. How are you?
How are you? Good evening, Ms. Farhad.
Thank you for noticing that. I wasn't sure how much of that. I'm a Palestinian American, and I'm very proud of you and all the work that you have done for this country, Ralph. It's
Thank
a pleasure.
You.
How long did it take you to write this voluminous book called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us Now?
Well, drawing on my experience over 40 years of how hard it is for the people of this country to overcome the entrenched power structure in Wall Street and Washington, it took me about 9 months.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. And of course, you have had incredible experience in this. You call this book a practical utopia. To me, that says that you have a belief that this is a doable practice, this healing of the world. Is that what your thoughts are? Do you believe that we can fix
well,
this?
Well, you know, most people think of utopia in science fiction terms. But historically, a utopia is a fair society, a society where there's fair play, justice, equality of opportunity, and nobody has too much power over anyone else. So it starts out with the English philosopher Thomas More, who wrote a book called Utopia in the 16th century, and it was a faraway land somewhere in the South Seas, and someone from England got there and came back and related the story of this prosperous, justice-filled economy and society. And since then, there have been utopias. The most famous one in American history is called Looking Backward by Edward Bellamy. Came out in 1887, and it sold 1 million copies in hardback. It was a sensation because it gave a vision of what our country could be like in the year 2000. Didn't turn out that way. But there are other things that students study in universities. They study dystopias. That's the opposite of utopia, like 1984. By Orwell or Brave New World by Huxley. I thought it's time to sort of bring that form of fiction writing back, and because it elevates our imagination to envision real possibilities in the country. And the storyline takes place in 2006 in the book Only the Super Rich Can Save Us, and it's led by Warren Buffett. These are real super rich, older in their 70s, 80s, 90s, enlightened Americans, and I put them in fictional roles. And they basically decide in a mountaintop hotel in Maui, where Warren Buffett from Omaha, Nebraska, multi-billionaire, summoned them, to put money and muscle behind justice movements from the community level in America all the way to Wall Street and Washington. So there's a titanic power struggle in the middle of the book that goes to the end of it. It's got a lot of civics, a lot of politics, but it really reads like a drama. And it's got good dialogue, good conversation. It might be used in government courses in high school and college someday, I hope. And I think Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes summed it up. She read it on her vacation and wrote me a nice letter saying she thought it was, quote, engrossing, creative, and funny, end quote. And I said, Leslie, I'll take all three. Because as you put it, it's over 700 pages, though the print is large.
Well, that was what struck not only myself, but a lot of the reviewers of the book. They all said that there was a lot of humor, and it was a relief. But let me ask you something, Ralph. Is there ever, in your mind, a probability that the super rich could come together one day and try to heal this world or this country?
Well, it's a matter of scale. They did it to some degree in the 19th century, funding the abolition of slavery movement. There were some pretty proper rich Bostonians who put a lot of money into the abolition movement. In the 50s and 60s of the 20th century, the civil rights movement, there were lots of rich families who put money in, like the Curry family of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
They were worth about $500 million at that time. The Stern family of New Orleans. There is precedent, but not on this level of magnitude. And what I tried to do in this book is say, look, there's hugely wealthy people in this country. A small number of them are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, and they're enlightened. They don't want to leave their beloved country in a state of decline. They want to look at their grandchildren in the eye, and they don't quite know what to do other than to give to charity, which is different than in this book, where they give billions of dollars to social justice community movements. I try to lay out a scenario for any super rich person who wants to read this book that if they don't want to do it on a national level, they can do it on a regional level, they can do it on a state level. That there are so many good neighborhood groups, community groups, naturally talented leaders all over the country, but they have no money to take on the big boys. They have no money to make government accountable. And so this is the thesis of the book, is that money and muscle by a small handful of mega billionaires, top-down, bottom-up mobilization of the people, around major redirections, some of which have already been adopted in Western Europe and Canada, like universal health insurance, can make a huge difference.
Well, why did you select this particular genre as a catalyst for? I mean, given the experiences that you've had in your life, given the programs that you've helped create, and so I couldn't see that it would have been a stretch to just make it a book about how to do it right.
Well, you couldn't do it in nonfiction. It would be very tedious. It would be like a policy book. Here's 10 ways to do this, or here are the 10 tips to mobilize. If people don't read it. I mean, I've written books like that. So they don't read it. They do read a story, a narrative that has drama in it. And also, it's easier to write. You can say a lot of things that can be done, and point, counterpoint, challenge, power struggle, that you can't really do on that scale with nonfiction. We have a lot of great books coming out in this country as a citizenry, muckraking books on every conceivable industrial crime or abuse or political corruption, and a lot of good documentaries too, but they're not making much difference. And that's because they don't really show how it can be done. And I show how it can be done. So if anybody's interested in real change in this country, just come into this book with an open mind. By the time you finish, you'll feel stronger as a citizen. You'll have a very interesting, exciting read. and you'll never be as inhibited again asking rich people in your community to give to good causes.
Let me ask you, was there a selection process in who you selected for the book as your characters?
Yes, I selected them because in one way or another they did some good things in their prior life. William Gates Sr. was part of 1,000 rich people who defeated the Republicans in Congress and saved the estate tax. Even though they were rich, they thought the estate tax was an equitable tax. And, you know, Ted Turner has given $1 billion to the United Nations 10 years ago. In this book, he forms an organization called Billionaires Against Bullshit. And, for example, Warren Buffett, of course, he's putting in over $30 billion in William Gates Foundation for deal with infectious diseases and other issues. I think he intends to help organize a lot of billionaires around the world. This is in real life. I had breakfast with him over 2 months ago in Omaha, and he wants to organize billionaires around the world to give 50% of their estate to improving their society. So he's thinking that way. And Joe Jamail, who's the only Arab American of the 17, he's a leading trial lawyer in Texas, who I can't even get on the line. He's a very idiosyncratic person. I couldn't even get him to recognize that he was in the book. But he starts invigorating all the small claims courts all over the country. Because the small claims courts, you know, were not designed just to be used by collection agencies against consumers. They were designed to be used by consumers without the need for a lawyer, simple procedure, in front of judges, like the television judges, Judge Judy, to go after credit card fraud or landlord abuses and so forth. So in this book, one of the first things he does is he funds a lot of law school clinics all over the country to give free advice and encourage people in the hundreds of thousands to use the small claims court. So you can see that, you know, in their past, they've done things. So I take them and I expand their impact enormously based on some of their own value systems in real life. Not entirely, but some of their own value systems in real life.
And place it into that utopian hierarchy.
Yeah. And Warren Beatty is in the book running against Governor Schwarzenegger for the governor of California in 2006.
I have to tell you that.
And I sent him the book, and he thought it might make a good movie.
Really? That's interesting. That's a pretty hefty movie. You'd have to really do some
copy. Yeah, you're right. He said it'd have to be stripped down.
But I have to tell you, the thought of Warren Beatty made me laugh just as much as the thought of Arnold Schwarzenegger being governor.
Well, that's why. You know, it took one to know one, you know. So,
exactly.
And Beatty's more substantive, but less decisive. And Schwarzenegger is very decisive. And that's the difference between the two. They both were interested in running for election, but he did it, Schwarzenegger.
And Beatty's still contemplating it. Very
He's
interesting.
Still contemplating, except in this book. He sheds his indecision in this book. It's a funny campaign, but it's very telling.
Well, let me ask you. You did an analysis, a commentary and analysis of the Obama administration in there. And his performance leads me to believe that he's kind of can't we all just get along kind of guy that beats his constituency into complacency while he's saying it. You're not real impressed with what's happening in the Obama administration?
No, I think he has an unwillingness. His personality, I just wrote a column on this. It's on commondreams.org, I believe. He has a personality that's you know, charitably can be called a harmony personality. He doesn't like take on the big drug companies or the defense companies that are ripping off the taxpayers. He's a concessionary person. And unfortunately, he came into office with a lot of liberal and progressives who he's turned his back on, and he's been conceding month after month to demands of big business. and not just the bailouts, not just the health care bill, not just the weak financial re-regulation bill of Wall Street. But the surprising thing is he hasn't really cracked down on all these contractors and all the procurement abuses that he should be really cracking down on, because conservatives and liberals don't like what's going on, like with Blackwater and Halliburton and KBR and so forth. I mean, the fraud, the waste, the abuse is just enormous, especially
it
now
is.
With the wars in
it
Iraq
is.
And Afghanistan.
You know, on our show, we do take questions from our listeners. Ralph, there's a couple of questions that are in the queue right now, if you don't mind.
Sure. I just want to point out that you can look at the reviews on the book on Amazon.com. And the book's a great Christmas and New Year's gift. They're in all the chain bookstores, independent bookstores in Michigan and elsewhere.
It's refreshing, too, that, and it is a plan for how it is possible. And based on realistic politics, based on a fictional scenario. So for those of you that are interested in saving the world, as I know a lot of people are, this is a fantastic book for you to read.
It's a key in it. $1 billion from, say, 6 or 7 multi-billionaires organizing congressional districts would get a single-payer health insurance through Congress in less than 2 years.
Exactly.
30% of the Congress privately is for single-payer, so is Obama, but they don't want to take on the big corporations. And the best example I can give is that George Soros was against the invasion of Iraq in 2002. Mm. In early 2003, he was vigorously against it. He wrote and he spoke against it. He's worth many billions of dollars. And at the same time, over 300 ex-generals, admirals, national security types, diplomats who were retired, some of whom have had a lot of support inside the Pentagon, were against Bush, Cheney, and the invasion of Iraq. They wrote op-eds. Mm-hmm. They spoke out. But no one ever organized them, put them on the media, gave them infrastructure, got them up, to have congressional hearings. Had he, George Soros, put in $100 million, and he made $3 billion in 2007 alone, to give you the scale. Had he put in $100 million to give a backing day after day, the 300 would have multiplied to 600 in the 6 month period. And who was going to be able to face down, battle-scarred veterans, generals, admirals, ambassadors, security advisors to George Herbert Walker Bush, his father, like Brent Scowcroft and Jim Baker. There was generals like General Zinni, Admiral Shanahan. But they did their thing. It didn't work because, remember Bush and Cheney were rolling the press and Congress in the juggernaut of lies that led to this horrific invasion with over 1 million Iraqis dying and thousands of U.S. soldiers died and tens of thousands sick and injured. They were rolling everybody, but there was one group they couldn't roll, and that's these retired, experienced veterans of both Republican and Democratic administrations, high offices, cabinet secretaries, heads of national security agency like retired General Bill Odom. And he didn't do it. And I would call him and during that time, and I couldn't even get through to him, George Soros. So that's an example where money and muscle could have prevented this horrific invasion of Iraq, the expansion of opposition to us as a result, a recruiting ground for fighters against us, hundreds of billions of dollars diverted from rebuilding the public infrastructure of America. So I do want to give a lot of examples. I hope after this book we can have conferences of very super rich, older, enlightened people and discuss all this. Elevate our imagination.
I agree with you, and unfortunately, though, a lot of people, such as Ed in Seattle, ask, many Americans believe that the country is controlled by a shadow government. Do you believe this? And if so, do you see a mechanism for undoing it?
Every society is. You look at any country in the world, Brazil, Japan, Russia, China, France, Italy, the entrenched power structure has a substructure to it.
And isn't that what you were just talking about, Ralph? These very people, Soros and the rest of them, that you couldn't get through and had the power to stop it and didn't?
I don't think they had the imagination. I don't think they even thought of it. I think Soros was frustrated. He probably made some calls to members of Congress or to some of these retired diplomats and generals, et cetera. He wrote some articles, and then he sort of said, well, you know, Bush and Cheney have too much power. I'm telling you, the level of imagination in this country to put money and muscle behind democratic movements for a better country and a higher level of justice for workers and consumers, patients, taxpayers, whatever, it is very, very low. I mean, we're nowhere near Western Europe, where after World War II, these countries were devastated, and their people, through their trade unions, their co-ops, their multi-party systems, not two-party tyranny here as here, they demanded and got universal health care for all the people, paid maternity leave, paid family sick leave, paid daycare, a decent public transit, tuition-free university, much better wages and pensions for the lower one-third of the workers in their country, and minimum 4 weeks paid vacation for everybody, not just for members of unions, everybody. 64 years later in the USA, we don't have any of these for everybody. So you see the expectation levels, the demand levels in European countries, Western Europe, is much higher than it is in our country. And the more we recognize how low our expectation level is, the more we say, why? Why is it so low? I mean, aren't we a rich country?
Why? Exactly, because it always goes back to, no matter what anybody says, we can continue to blame administrations and governments until doomsday or until some utopia comes along. However, we are directly responsible for what's happening.
We're the ones who let it happen, and we're the ones who can make it change. We're the only ones in the Constitution. There's no word corporation in our Constitution.
No.
There's no word political party in our Constitution. So why do corporations and their toady political two-party tyranny control us? You see what I mean? I mean, we start out with a great advantage. Besides, the corporations have money and power in Washington. They don't have a single vote. We have to organize the votes, laser beam them, condition them, have more candidates on the ballot, not just Republican, Democrat. And you'd be surprised how fast we can turn the country around. You know, there are only 535 men and women in Congress.
The most amazing thing, Ralph, is that people sit there and say, well, how do we do it? Well, here, look at you. You just roll these ways and methodologies and means. You've got how many pages is this book? 700 and something of ways to do it. There are millions of ways to do it. It's just a matter of doing it. One thing,
you don't exaggerate what it takes, because there are only 535 men and women in Congress. They put their shoes on every day the way you and I do. About 1,500 corporations, and you know their names, ExxonMobil and Pfizer and Citigroup and so on, get their way with a majority of those members. And these corporations don't have a single vote. We're the ones back home who have the votes. We're the ones who are looking the other way. We're the ones who are spending hours looking at screens and talking on cell phones while they run our country into the ground, ship our industries and jobs to communist and fascist regimes abroad, like the auto supply industry and the auto industry. And we're the ones who are suffering, but we're the ones who have the incipient power to turn it around. And that means we got to respect ourselves as citizens, as voters, put time in. You don't just knee-jerk, oh, this politician's got such a nice smile. He sent me a letter when my daughter graduated from high school. No. You evaluate them in accordance to their response to your agenda, in accordance with their record and votes, and in accordance with the degree to which they believe that they have to shift power from the few in Washington and Wall Street to the many back home. We have a website, Only the Super Rich .org, for your reaction, your suggestions, after you read this book.
Okay, now, you heard that. OnlyTheSuperRich.org. And please, get the book, read it, and I think we need a dialogue. We have to have this dialogue, and there's a forum for the dialogue. A couple of real quick questions, if we can get them in. Mike in California asks, at this point, would you say that Obama is an Uncle Tom rather than an Uncle Sam?
Well, I said a year ago that we will see in about a year whether Barack Obama will be an Uncle Tom groveling before the giant corporations that are running our country into the ground, or whether he'll be an Uncle Sam standing up for the people. The record for the last 12 months almost is that he has been the former, not the latter. And I know a lot of African Americans over the years who have been pretty upset with African American politicians who turn their back on their own people. And you know, during the campaign, Barack Obama did not campaign in poor areas. He did not talk about poverty very much. He didn't talk about the poor. It was mostly middle class. He used Clinton's middle class, not the poor, which is getting bigger than the middle class, by the way. And he raised more money from corporate interests and, quite importantly, corporate lawyers by far than John McCain or any other presidential candidate in American history. Why did they invest in him? Because he was their man.
Exactly.
Very disappointing. We all want him to succeed, but that's not what it is. So now we have to give him the backbone, the strength, the fortitude, and only the people can do that.
Well, I appreciate your talking with us tonight. I wish you the greatest success. Briefly, is there anything new on the agenda for you this year? Was this book meant to be your last call to arms, Ralph?
No, we're still working on Congress to get a better health policy and regulate Wall Street and shift more and more taxes from the backs of working people to those things that society likes the least or dislikes the most. That means we should tax more corporate crime. We should tax pollution with a carbon tax. Above all, and this is a huge revenue source, we should tax Wall Street speculation like derivatives. Because Wall Street's supposed to favor investment over speculation. And in recent decades, it's subordinated investment to speculation, otherwise known as gambling with other people's money to make more money. And a mere one-half of 1% tax on
trillions
of dollars of derivatives every year could bring a lot of revenue and relieve the working
people. Yeah, we call
that
a casino here in Michigan.
Yeah, there's an example. The more casinos are built, the more factories are shut down, the more decay is demonstrated in our society.
Absolutely. Well, it's been wonderful having you again. The book is Only the Super Rich Can Save Us Now. Go out and buy the book. It is absolutely something that you need to have in your library to refer to in a number of different ways. The website that after you've read the book, it is onlythesuperrich.org. So please go ahead.
Merry Christmas and New Year gift, and it's in the bookstores.
And I want to personally thank you, Mr. Ralph Nader, for being not only a guest on our show, but one of the finest American citizens I know.
You're very kind. Thank you very much, Ms. Farha, and thank you, your listeners.
Good night, everybody. We'll see you all next week. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure having you, and good night, folks. Let the people speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the seawall by the relief office I saw my people, and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land was made for you and me.